creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we feature Assistant Professor of History at Winona State University, Eric Heinrich's talk, From Plague to Plainview. In this first part, Eric will speak on how patent medicine started, with specific emphasis on a German doctor named Kegler. We'll also explore how alchemy became popular and how medicines sparked entrepreneurship. I'm Terry Tensett, taking you to the Winona History Center for our presentation, From Plague to Plainview. You're listening to Culture Click.
So I'm a specialist in late medieval and early modern period. So that's more like around 1500. Early modern goes up to about French Revolution or 1750, as some say. But I recently taught a history of medicine course here at Winona State in this past semester, so I've learned a lot more about the modern part of this medical story. And so I'd like to give you a kind of broad look at these early brand name medicines, because some of my research deals with an early form that I found in old sources, 500-year-old books, basically. And so I've been uncovering this story for quite some time, and so this is an extended version of that. And we're going to end in Winona with Watkins as well. So we'll be coming back to this slide, but this is one of the more famous Watkins products of the past, the Watkins liniment. All right, so brand names though. So basically, if you think about it, brand names, it's hard to say when exactly brand names first came into existence, because anytime you take some sort of medicine and you put it on the marketplace, it could technically be a brand name. So brand names have probably existed as long as people have been selling medicines. I mean, this dates back to civilization, the beginnings of civilization. But over time, you can see changes in these kinds of brand names, the kinds that are selected and how they're marketed. And so some of my work has dealt with the emergence of more kind of modern brand names. During the Middle Ages, you had brand names. Some examples are Venetian theriac, which was, you know, theriac was a pretty general medicine, but this one was tied specifically to Venice. It was usually made in Venice under strict controls, so people could be ensured of the quality of the medicine. They also had medicines named after people, like the pills of Rufus, which was an old Arab physician, and Mithridate, which was named after a Greek king during the Roman period. So there are those sorts of things, but I noticed a new trend around 1500 of what I call the dawn of modern brand names. So what I noticed then is a new sort of brand names began to appear there, named specifically after doctors who claim to have invented some sort of new product. And it's also tied into new changes in technology, communication technology, such as print. I mean, they could advertise their wares better at that time, just getting their word out in print. So I'll go into those changes, but I thought I'd give a brief overview here of brand names. So you have this very early phase of this kind of early modern Europe of early brand names. 18th century is sometimes known as the golden age of consumerism. Population in Europe is bigger. There's more wealth from this European economy that is tied to the larger world. This is the time when you see things like Wedgwood dishes became really famous, like porcelain figurines as collector's items and consumer items. But you also have a thriving medical marketplace during this 18th century as well. But there's also bigger attempts to regulate that marketplace in the 18th century. So you don't necessarily have patent medicines around 1500. They slowly start to emerge, but you really get them after 1700 or so, when, you know, city authorities, government authorities are more up to the task of trying to regulate the larger population. So, you know, the system of patents then was one of these steps to try to, you know, impose some order so that people could know, you know, people weren't stealing each other's secrets on medicines, and you could know exactly you could know exactly you're getting the right product. But basically, some people say the next century then is the golden age of patent medicines because at this time, I mean, this consumer world is even bigger and you have, you know, new technology that helps these entrepreneurs reach a bigger population as well. So this kind of consumer world of the 18th century only grows into the 19th century, and they say this is even bigger and better age. So one problem with the history of medicine is that we know there's a scientific revolution in the 17th century, but was there a scientific revolution in medicine during this early modern time? No, not really. I mean, you don't really have scientific medicine until around 1900, you know, a scientific medicine that can actually, you know, treat most of the things that sick people have. And so before that, I mean, in a way, physics was way ahead of medicine and just sort of like turned to a more sort of modern form. Basically, this world where it seems like physicians aren't completely up to the job and their profession isn't completely up to the job to really medicate society of its aches and pains. You have this world then where you have a lot of entrepreneurs who aren't doctors or, you know, they don't have the same university training as doctors, step in to fill that void. And one thing that made this 19th century the golden age of this patent medicine is that the doctor's medicine was also usually unpopular. Doctors don't have that high exalted status yet that they would achieve later with scientific medicine. So what you would get from a doctor is often, at this time, kind of harsh treatments, harsh medicine sometimes, but also bloodletting that would take, I mean, scientifically we know this kind of weakens the body. You know, it's not hard to imagine why the doctor's medicine of the 19th century was not very popular. And people often turned to alternatives that seemed better, more effective, or at least less harsh. So these include things like homeopathy, mesmerism. And this is the whole time the Christian Science movement began, where people were rejecting doctors and doctors' medicines, looking for more kind of spiritual forms of healing. But part of this larger picture then are these medical entrepreneurs who are stepping up with their bold claims. I've always used this medicine, it's always worked, I developed it in my woodshed, that sort of thing. So we'll examine some of these here today. But then when you get to the 20th century though, let me just complete this story. That's when you get more of a scientific medicine that's based on microbiology. They finally understand really well what's going on, or somewhat good, in the microbial world and how to fight it. And it really kind of peaks by World War II when you get antibiotics that seem like these wonder drugs. Or some people have described in the 20th century, medicine suddenly became the fairy godmother that can cure everybody of anything that they have, or at least that was the optimism of the time. So that's when doctors really kind of achieve that God in the white coat status, when they can decide between life and death and they have such powers of nature at their disposal. But that was a long time coming. I mean, that's really sort of not the norm in the history of medicine. Let's move on to one of my figures then. I'm going to focus on a person that I found in the sources that really helps us rethink the history of these early brands named medicines. And it's connected to the plague. So basically, you've probably heard of the Black Death. That was the big plague epidemic of Europe and Asia around 1350 or so. It killed millions in Asia, Europe, as well as North Africa. But basically, too often though, knowledge of the history of plague ends there. But the reality is that plague epidemic continued for the next 300 years, or you have periodic epidemics of that same, probably the same sickness for the next 300 years. So while everyone knows that first big dramatic wave, there's been more attention by historians of that later 300 years to try to figure out what's going on and how does plague medicine change exactly. So what's going on during these 300 years or so after 1350? Well, this is the first kind of global age in world history where all the continents were brought together for the first time into contact with each other. That was done by European sailors and merchants, explorers in general. But it had catastrophic effects on the history of the world. And especially in North and South America, where millions of people died because of these epidemics that had only before been in Asia or Africa or Europe. So you had a situation where millions of people were dying, especially in the New World. But things were rough in Europe as well. Not quite as bad as the New World, but you had these continuing epidemics. So here's just a list of what's going on. The epidemics going through Northern Europe, or especially Central Europe, the Holy Roman Empire at this time, where these figures that I've studied lived. And so what were doctors doing at this time? Well, they often responded with printed pamphlets to try to advise people of how to, you know, give them advice on how to prevent the plague or this epidemic, or how to cure it if you did, in fact, come down with it. So yeah, let me just comment on a few of these, I guess. So on this list is both plagues as well as some new sicknesses that maybe came from the New World. It's hard to say exactly. But you get a sense that they had to deal with new epidemics as well as old epidemics that were, you know, longtime foes. So this is part of the context where doctors began to rethink medicine. So we have new diseases out there. It seems like we're going to have to come up with new medicines to try to treat those. So one example is the French disease. Does anybody know the other name of the French disease?
Syphilis.
Syphilis, good. For some reason, it got blamed on France. I mean, today with naming of epidemics, it often happens as well. Like, I think the swine flu was first called the Mexican flu or something like that, which may or may not be fair, especially with the French disease. But the English were blamed for this sickness. It seemed to break out first in England in 1529. All right, so all kinds of epidemics, some of them new, creates a new situation. And so doctors respond with pamphlets like this. And so this is a German language print from 1495 by a doctor, Philippus Kulmacher. He's actually lives in Hungary. He says up at the top he's from Eger, which is there's a lot of Germans living in Eastern Europe at this time. So basically these were long books, well, sometimes short, sometimes long, that tried to help people deal with this sickness. And it would talk about prevention, talk about cures, and give recipes, and sometimes lead people to the local pharmacies to find the medicines that they need. And this is more specifically the one that I dealt with. This guy, Caspar Kegler, this is his pamphlet from 1592. And oftentimes they have religious, especially before the Reformation really unfolds, they have religious pictures on the cover as well. Which, you know, I can maybe take questions about that later, but I won't say too much about the religious side to plague medicine. But basically, so I spent a long time in Germany going through libraries, finding these, because there's no comprehensive list of where these are and what they say. I mean, some of these pamphlets nobody has read for 200 years or so. So it's really kind of exciting going into one of these rare book rooms and, you know, reading this kind of new information, trying to make use of it. This is another place I went. This is a great little library in northern Germany that the town is so small that it was never targeted during World War II, which is a great thing because they have a huge collection of early modern books. The local dukes here collected books for basically since the beginning of the printing press. They always were buying books and assembling them in their private library. And here's another great place to do research in Nuremberg, the German National Museum and Library. So basically, I was able to go through the catalogs at these places, and it turned out that this one figure, Caspar Kegler, even though there's almost nothing known about this man, was actually the most popular author of the time. So that seemed like a good sort of historical mystery for me to explore and learn something new. But as I dug deeper, it seems like there's various reasons for his popularity. And I think one of them is this brand name medicine that he developed, which this is like maybe the first brand name medicine in a kind of modern sense. That's at least what I argued once in an article. And nobody's disputed my claim, so that's pretty great. I guess it's been accepted by the people in the field. What about Kegler here? This product he developed, Dr. Caspar Kegler, is a lectuary. An lectuary is a medicine that's like, it's mixed. It's a lot of things mixed together and prepared into a paste. And the paste was often taken sometimes in the form of pills, but sometimes just by spoon. You could take this paste. And this pill in particular was rooted in a secret alchemical preparation that was guarded by the Caspar Kegler family. And he claimed that it had been tested in a lifetime of practice. So nobody should have doubts of whether this thing works. He was a plague doctor in the city of Leipzig for over 30 years. He saw these epidemics that I just covered. He was treating patients in the local hospital during these plague epidemics. And so he, you know, from his own empirical observations, he was able to create this claim. I have something that really works. And a lot of people were convinced by this kind of argument. All right, so alchemy though. So he claimed to extract, you know, certain healing powers from medicines like juniper and unicorn horn, which is actually a real thing. It wasn't just some sort of mythical beast. It was actually a thing that you would see down at the pharmacies. It was some sort of tusk sometimes, or the horn of a narwhal. You know, the narwhal is kind of that twisted, I think it's technically a tusk, although I'm not a biologist, but that was a real thing. And so he claimed to use alchemy. So at the time, alchemy was not part of the medical sciences, though. It had always been sort of external to a doctor's training. You wouldn't learn about alchemy at the university. You'd learn about alchemy from miners and men who worked with their hands. There's a real separation at this time between the scholars who use books and the men who use their hands, who have a very empirical understanding of nature. But it seems like Kegler, in embracing this empirical, hands-on experience with nature, is trying to bridge that world between the books and the theories of the time and people who actually do things with their hands. Because doctors at the time never touched patients, they didn't prepare their own medicines typically, so they wouldn't do things with their hands. But to get a scientific revolution, you're going to need both, right? People who know things, who know the big ideas, but also the people who know how nature works. All right, so ultimately, I think that's why Caspar Kegler is important, not just because he was one of the most popular authors of the 16th century within plague literature, but also because he seems to be anticipating this scientific revolution that came a century later, more or less. All right, so this just shows a kind of fantastic still for distilling. And so that was one of the tools in the alchemist's bag of tricks, was using, you know, distilling to kind of extract certain chemicals out of plants or minerals and things like that. But this man was also, he's very kind of modern in his entrepreneurial approach to medicine, and found in old documents that he owned a shop underneath the, you know, these arches of Leipzig City Hall. So probably there's all kinds of shops, even today, in Leipzig's City Hall. And so that was a good place to sell medicines. And it was kind of rare for doctors at the time to be in the medical sales business rather than just kind of giving advice to patients. And so that's another reason he's unusual. And every year, three times a year, Leipzig had an imperial market, which meant that merchants from the entire region would come to Leipzig to trade. And so this seemed like, it seemed like Caspar Kegler was in the right place at the right time to develop some sort of new medicine to sell, because it was just a great commercial hub of the region. And so this is just a 19th century illustration of what that looked like. But the other thing that seemed really pretty modern about Caspar Kegler is his use of print. And so print is relatively new. Nobody really knows how to use it yet, but he's one of these entrepreneurs who really kind of popularizes his ideas in vernacular print. So, you know, the first books were often in Latin, aimed at scholars. They're usually pretty expensive. But by the time the Reformation happens, about 1520s, print is suddenly mass-produced, and it's oftentimes done in the German language. And so this doctor is using that kind of trend in culture to sell his more kind of popular medicine. All right, so this map shows places where Kegler's texts were printed. And let me just point out Leipzig and Dresden. Basically, you can see a lot of these cities are centered around this kind of north central Germany. But he was fairly widespread, printed in widespread cities. You have one in Austria, Graz, and you have Cologne. And up here, don't miss Königsberg, which is Russia today. And here's Constance down here. And actually, the text printed in Constance, Germany, was translated into Dutch. It's kind of weird. And it's probably because Constance is on the Rhine. The book salesman was probably looking to go down the Rhine to the Netherlands to sell the book there. So, you know, the secret is sort of this approach to medicine quickly escapes Leipzig and goes to a lot of different places. But basically what we can see here is, you know, this use of secrecy, this use of the new communication of the time. It seems like in this kind of entrepreneurial approach that he has, it seems like this figure is anticipating this consumer revolution that historians say happens later. This is just kind of an early figure in this process of a more consumer-oriented medicine. At the time, as I said, doctors weren't very popular. They would maybe only treat 10% of the population. But it seemed like figures like Caspar Kegler were trying to grow the market share that physicians had by offering medicines that seemed to appeal to the broader population. I mean, and we know that alchemy was, I mean, people really liked alchemical products for medicine at the time, especially something like, can anyone name an alchemical product that we have today in medicine or? What?
Aspirin.
Well, I'm not sure about that one. I think that was from the 19th century, but it starts with al. Good. Just like alchemy, alcohol is one of the products of that these alchemists were investigating. It was a powerful substance that would have an effect on the body. Usually good. I mean, I guess it depends on the dose. So yeah, embracing these alchemical medicines was part of this story of hard alcohol, especially popularizing hard alcohol or hard alcoholic mixtures as medicines in Europe. And people really liked it and it seemed to work. So yeah, so going forward, this is sort of like an important tool that doctors are catching on to, that it's going to help them grow their market share within the society. The other thing, it seemed like doctors oftentimes didn't give patients what they wanted. What typically do people want out of their medicines? I mean, ideally, you would just take one pill and all your problems are solved, right? So I saw this cartoon in the New Yorker. It says, ask your doctor if taking a pill to solve all your problems is right for you. I mean, that's what people want out of medicine, more or less. Something that's quick and easy. But what you would typically get from doctors at that time is usually they would prescribe a long process in order to achieve health. And I mean, I guess critics of medicine today would say, well, that's actually what we need. We need diet, exercise, and kind of moderate lifestyles in order to achieve health. That's not solved by taking one pill here and there. But this tends to be much more profitable and much more popular among society. But yeah, but what would you get from a doctor at the time? Oftentimes they would say things like, it'd be a week regimen of moderating diet and exercise. You know, it would take you out of your normal routine probably. And people don't want to adjust their habits or adjust their weekly routines. So you can see why university-trained physicians wouldn't have been so popular at the time. So at this time then, alcohol was catching on even as a cure-all. And I found one pamphlet from 1531 that recommends 22 medicinal uses of brandy as a sort of cure-all. And these are some claims that it makes. It's good on all swellings, helps the tongue, is good for teeth when held in the mouth, is good for cancer, and my favorite is It's not bad when poured on wounds, since it dispels all poisons. So, I mean, this was not by an important doctor of the time. This is just sort of general medical advice from the marketplace at the time. I mean, they were clearly aware. I mean, this hard alcohol is a relatively new substance to them because they had just achieved stills that could produce that substance. But they knew that, you know, you pour it on a wound and it's going to heal better because it's an antiseptic. They didn't understand microbes yet, of course. But people were aware that this was an interesting, medically interesting chemical that's going to actually help people. All right, so more or less, Kegler embraces a more empirical approach to his medicine. So here's some of Kegler's words about his healing. Take the following medicine as instructed and sweat. Take the powder, the onion water, my electuary, or my aqua vita, which is the most sure among others, and all medicines. I have experienced its effect as often as I have used it, unlike others. Therefore, I have trusted it the most and have taken it myself when in need. I have also saved the lives of my wife, children, and entire household many times, using it with divine help. So while most physicians at the time would talk about, I learned this medicine from the great ancient physicians, and they would list a bunch of scholarly names as the basis of why you should try this medicine, his approach is different too, because he says, you should take it because I've used it all the time, even on my own kids, and it seems to work. So that's a completely different argument that would be more popular to people at the time. I mean, very few people would be convinced by, take this medicine because Hippocrates, an ancient Greek physician, said it works. That may not work, but I tried this on my wife and kids. That would seem to have a better effect. The biggest point here deals with Kegler's appreciation of experience and this manual experimentation in alchemy. And so they're de-emphasizing learned tradition here in the books of the time, and they're trying to bring in more direct observation and experience with nature into the medical sciences at that point. I mean, clearly you don't have modern medicine emerging at this time, but you have a small step in that direction because, you know, to get real science, you're going to have the thinkers and the scholars getting together with those people who use their hands. So he's sort of a bridge figure in that way. Also in general, what I'm also trying to say here is that he was important, you know, this is a modern brand name medicine because he embraces the most recent communication technology to sell it. And, you know, this entrepreneurship seems to be new too. It's a very sort of aggressive way of getting your name out there and getting yourself in local markets, which wasn't necessarily the case during the Middle Ages. People didn't view money as necessarily good during the Middle Ages. But that's changing in this new kind of global world of the 16th century, when there's a new global economy starting to emerge. People take a different attitude during this kind of Renaissance time to goods and money in general. This is the beginnings of capitalism, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Thanks again to Assistant Professor of History at Winona State University, Eric Heinrichs, and his presentation, From Plague to Plainview, as given at the Winona History Center. Tune in for part two next week when we go over the history of patent medicines and take a look at Watkins' own liniment and other solutions. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.